I want to then take you to the other side of how peace, not only for only one section of society, if peace and justice has to be the hallmark of progress in society, women must not only fight for it, but be recipients of it as well. In Pakistan, women's rights was not a word that was known till 1980s. And as I said to one of my friends yesterday, that there were all these little women's organizations who believed that if you gave every woman a sewing machine, you would empower her. Now that concept has come to an end in Pakistan. And it came to an end when the more emancipated world was backing up General ضیاء-الحق because they needed him for his war in Afghanistan. And because he wanted support inside Pakistan, he was kowtowing to his right-wing constituency. And there were laws upon laws that were being made which were anti-women. And this is when women came out in the streets and not only challenged the spurious Islamization of ضیاء-الحق, but also dictatorship and dictatorship. We were obviously, they were stunned that these women had actually dared to come out. We were badly beaten. Since I was short, I was not so beaten as my tall colleagues. And we were hauled up, taken to the police station. But it was the anger inside the women. We were much, much younger at that time. And the resolve. These were women who had never, ever seen a police station from outside, leave alone from inside. But they were there, and when they were told to leave, they said, "We will not leave. We will not leave until we do not hear an apology from the government over the radio. Give us a radio set." And there was no place to keep so many women in the police station. But we decided that we will stay there, and that is what is networking. We had the lawyers in the city bring us food. They were standing outside the gates. They were raising slogans. We were responding to those slogans. More and more people started to collect outside. It was amazing for that city to have so many women being so happy inside a police station. And finally, at 10 o'clock, the apology came over the radio. And so we went home, only to encounter the next day that the mullah had said, and mullah is our clergy, had said that all the women who were out there in the streets, their marriages have been now dissolved. So one of the mullah came to my father-in-law and said, "You know, your son's marriage, we have dissolved it. We have given a fatwa." And my poor father-in-law was a businessman, really scared of what would happen. So he said, "I'll meet you at her father's house." And my father was quite complacent, said, "Let him come." So when the mullah came and said, "You know, Mr. So-and-so, we have given a fatwa. Your marriage of your daughter has been dissolved." So my father said, "I think my son-in-law has bribed you." And the mullah didn't know where to look. And he said, "Mr. Mullah, what have I done? And my friend, Mr. Ahmed, done? We can give you the same bribe. Please get rid of our wives as well." So the mullah really couldn't go very far. And this continued for many years. We were later on picked up, we were house arrested, we were followed. And what were we being followed for? Because we were meeting our female friends. I mean, they were following us because we were meeting women activists. And as I said this morning, one of the women who actually used to run a cooking class gave a little ad saying that she was holding cake demonstration on Sunday, was picked up and taken to the police station and asked what kind of demonstration it was. I mean, that is the kind of fear that the men who bear arms do have about women, because they don't know what we are. They don't know where we come from. They don't know in what kind of, you know, mold they have to put us in. And then because we were meeting and we were plotting and planning, we were picked up one day. I was picked up just by driving in the street, made a military under trial, taken to prison, threatened that I'll never be released, court-martialed, my children will never see my face. But I must say that there were 15 of us in that prison. There was never a moment, dull moment in the prison. We made life miserable for people in the for the superintendent. And finally, because we were so many of us, and we had created such a mess there, that they released us. And the superintendent jail, whom I now meet very regularly, who was superintendent jail at that time, said to me that I used to get regular headaches every day. And they were all ages. My age, an older woman, a much older woman, and a woman about, at that time, at the age that I am now, 60, was there with us. And she would pretend to have a heart attack in the middle of the night. And then call the superintendent and say, all I want is a bottle of Coke. And maybe it's gas, she would say. So get me a bottle of Coke. But every day, every midnight, she would get the whole staff up. In any event, I do believe that when we as women are fighting for our rights, we must command respect, not to be patronized, because we have been patronized enough. We want genuine respect, we want genuine dignity that we deserve. I think that when we are talking about justice, we also talk about justice to minorities, not just religious minorities, but ethnic minorities, people, gender, people who are lesbians and gays, they must have their rights too. And this is somewhere where the buck stops. When I was special rapporteur on extrajudicial killings, I was talking about many of the gays who got extrajudicially shot and killed by police in Brazil, and that they were given impunity, the police, on killing them. But there was an uproar in the third committee in the GA, because I was told by many of the countries, including my own, what rights are you talking about? There are no gays in Pakistan. So I said, well, if there are no gays in Pakistan, then it shouldn't affect you. But at least half the countries were absolutely convinced that there are no gays in their country. So I think we also need to tell our governments that people no longer are simple. People have information and far more knowledge than governments have. And that they have to recognize the fact that the world is not simplistic, and that we must give people, regardless of where they come from, their rights. I had a problem, for example, in our country, we had a system of separate electorates, like Muslim votes for Muslim, Christian votes for Christians, Parsis votes for Parsis. And the result was a complete division. So nobody cared about what the non-Muslim was saying. And it took us many years to contest and to fight and to make people realize that this was an unfair system. First, we had to actually convince the non-Muslims themselves that this was unfair to them, because there were obviously a few grandstanders who felt that, well, they'll win elections every time. So why was this election being taken away from them? But the rest of the non-Muslim population suffered. And then eventually, now it is almost abolished. I also had a problem looking at anti-conversion laws when I was special rapporteur on extrajudicial, on freedom of religion. Because everybody says that they can convert to my religion, but if they convert to the other religion, then they have committed a crime. And this logic, you could not get to them, because you said, well, you say that they can convert to yours, but you can't convert out. They say, yeah, but that's our belief, but that's not their belief. And I have to say that I then realized that there are certain religions that do not go out for conversion. And for them, it is very painful when aggressive conversion is done amongst members of their co-religious. For example, Parsis and Buddhists do not believe in proselytization, whereas Muslims and Christians do. So where are we going to create that balance? Surely it cannot be done by law. It has to be done by better understanding. I am going to end very briefly now, but I want to make two or three points on activism. The first point I want to make is that when you're an activist, and I have learned a lot from my senior colleagues, that you have to be more strategic. You have to plan, and you have to build support. It is not what you are trying to do advocacy for in terms of thematic advocacy that has to be continuous. But when you take a particular case, you must be sure that that case is a genuine case, that that case is a case that stands above the other cases. And your timing is also something of consequence. I say this because on the field we have a problem. Sometimes non-governmental NGOs, non-governmental organizations, international ones, or international institutions, pick up a particular case and take it out of context and blow it out of all proportion, which becomes a problem for us when we are on the field because we know they have got the facts wrong. And I can give you some hilarious examples of it, of institutes in the West that you really do respect, but they have made some colossal mistakes of picking up cases which are blatantly fraudulent. And we have had to sit there, defend them, knowing fully well that the person has made this huge mistake. So it is important to verify. Secondly, I think that non-governmental organizations have certain lessons to learn. And this is something that we are learning ourselves. We are all on the learning curve. Many of us begin to feel that we are a replacement for political parties. We believe that politics is a dirty word, that politics itself is dirty. But unless you don't have a political mind, you can never be a good human rights advocate. You must be politically aware of what is happening. And then you have to build linkages. If you are doing capital punishment, then capital punishment, abolition of capital punishment is also linked with rule of law. And rule of law is also linked with lobby with parliamentarians. You cannot all do it by yourself. Plus, I have noticed in my country, I cannot say about other countries, if a particular issue has cropped up and it has gained some kind of attention for the time being, everybody gets onto that issue and dumps whatever they are doing. So there have been times where I have to have had to, like other people, address the same topic 5 times in the same month. And then 2 years later, that topic is gone. So its consistency is something that we must retain. And we have to understand that we cannot do it all. We have to do it in partnership with each other. We must learn to use the mainstream media more effectively, because I notice that the right wing, those people and those lobbies that do not believe in a democratic culture, those lobbies that do not believe in peaceful coexistence, use the media very effectively. We must have superior knowledge of what we are doing than the other person. Because if we are doing something which we say we are experts on, we must be able to have the facts on our fingertips. And credibility is an issue with many of the NGOs around the world. We must make ourselves so credible that the constituency takes ownership of what we are doing. If people begin to say, The Human Rights Commission said it, and we believe them. That means that you have credibility, not because you say that what I have said is correct. And we have to have respect for the target group, respect their privacy, their confidentiality. And this I say because I have noticed that we run a shelter home as well for women. And we have enormous demands on us, asking whether they can interview these women. And there have been times when women have been interviewed without their knowing, and their clips have been used, which I think is not fair on them. But finally, I would like to say that I am certain that if we all walk together, all walk together to gain freedom, I am certain we can. It will not be an hour earlier. It will be many decades earlier. Thank you.